This is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. This is the show where we try and learn all the secrets of stuff inside the universe. Now, this week we learn about one of the most deadly snakes in the world. Also, we'll chat about some of the most strange and wondrous things that you might not know about in nature. And I'll answer some of your questions. Today they're about tornadoes, your joints, and oranges as well. That's on the way. First, let's catch up with one of our favourite geniuses here on the Science Weekly, who we've not heard of in a while. This is Sir Sidney McSprocket, talking about how things that we use every single day, pretty much, are made.
How's it made?
Oh, hello. Sir Sidney McSprocket here. I've been in action capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather splendid stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. Just watch. How are tin cans made? Oh, the sort you get busy popping. Well, I see that the aluminium that the cans are made from is derived from an ore called bauxite. Oh, and that quite a lot of the aluminium used also comes from recycled cans. There's tiny amounts of other metals too, like magnesium and copper.
Step one.
The first step is cutting a blank. A big lump of aluminium is rolled into a thin sheet and a 14-centimetre circle is cut out. This will make the base and sides of the can. The circles are laid out in a way that leaves as little waste as possible. A bit like when your granny makes biscuits with a pastry cutter.
Step two.
The next step is called drawing the cup. Another machine punches and pulls the circle into a can shape and a bump is pressed into the base, all in about 1/5 of a second.
Step three.
Now it's time to trim the ears. Oh, you may well say a tin can hasn't got ears. Why would it need them? This expression just means that the top of the can sometimes looks a bit wavy, and so it's trimmed to make it smooth and level.
Step four.
Cleaning and decorating comes next, and varnishes are used to make sure the drink doesn't get spoiled by the metal. A neck is also created, which will be folded over once the lid is added. At this point, the can will be sent to a drinks company to be filled with delicious fizzy pop.
Step five.
Now, once the pop is inside, we're going to need a lid to prevent spillage. Oh, it has to be thicker than the walls of the can to withstand the pressure of the beverage inside the can, and includes a ring pull to enable you to liberate the contents into your mouth. The lid is attached to the can by pressing and folding the edges together. And here is a fun bit of information to take away. The manufacturing process is so efficient that only about 1 in 50,000 cans will have a defect. Now, I must get on, but come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
Remember, if you've got any science question at all that you want answered on this show, let me know. Let me try and sort it out and solve it for you. Throw it over as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. That is what Tommy has done. Hey, Tommy. He's 8 years old. And he's asked quite a nice, simple one, actually. What's the difference between oranges, clementines, mandarins and tangerines? Well, Tommy, they're all from the same family, the citrus family, just like limes and lemons are from the same family, but they're separate pieces of fruit. You see, tangerines were imported to America ages ago from Tangier in Morocco, hence the name, tangerines. They're smaller, they're softer than oranges. Yeah, mandarins, they're from China. They're all different sizes and sweetness. These similar fruits, they've got a lot of likeness, but because they're made in different parts of the world, they grow from different soils in different temperatures, which also makes them taste different. Thanks for the question, Tom. This is from Alana, who is 11, going into year 7 high school this week. Alana, don't worry, it'll be fine. Because you're interested in science, that means you're going to do incredibly well. Alana asks, why do joints click? Now, there are three main reasons why your joints click, really. Either tendons slipping over bumps. It's not a problem normally. Also, bones can rub against each other. That makes another click. That can be an issue because it could be a sign of arthritis. But for a normally, every day, the reason that they click is because gas builds up within a joint where you're working, where you're using it every day. And when you suddenly move, stretch, or stretch that joint, it releases the gas and it pops. And when you do that a lot, the joints become slippery, so it means they fall out of place often and they pop more frequently. And also, thank you so much for the question, Alana, and hello to your best mate, Emma T. And finally, this is from Rebecca, who asks, how do tornadoes start? Now, Rebecca, this is a big old one. I could give you like a really detailed answer, but we don't have time on the pod today. So I'll kind of quickly run through it for you. Tornadoes start, they form from thunderstorms. And when warm rising air gets to the top, it meets cool dry air. And when they meet each other, the movement of the air current through the air, it creates a change of atmosphere. This makes a really, really fast whipping current of air. It quickly becomes a cyclone. And because the storm already has fast winds going on all around it, it's been in a thunderstorm, it whips that cyclone round and round and round. And sometimes a tornado can last for up to an hour and it can cause an incredible amount of damage. So thank you so much for the question, Rebecca. Nice to know. If you've got a question that you want answered on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, you need to leave it for us as a review over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This week we're joined by the nature writer Ben Hoare. He's written a book from DK. It's called The Wonders of Nature, and it features 100 just incredibly amazing things that are out there in the natural world. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
No, please. Thank you so much for joining us. This book, before we get into the root and branch science of the thing, I mean, yeah, it is an absolute spectacle. It is stunning. How much say did you have into just the design of the thing?
Oh, you produce books like this as a team, but I think it's really important that the book looks beautiful. My two daughters, who are 9 and 8, they're a good guide, really. They're not interested in books if the books look boring. I think books have to be engaging, and they have to look great. And so the illustrators, Angela and Daniel, have done an amazing job.
Now, I've already said there are 100 things in here, amazing discoveries, stuff that exists that's out there in the natural world. How did you, what were your guidelines? What were the kind of perimeters that you set yourself if something could be included in these 100 things?
So actually, this book is a follow-up, because last year in 2018, we did a book called The Anthology of Intriguing Animals. And that book was a bestseller. It did really well. And it had 100 different animals. And it had some quite well-known ones, like, you know, giant panda and a tiger and things like that. But this book, we wanted to go a little... We've got quite a few more unusual things in it. So, for example, we've got a whole section of microlife, things that really are too small for us to see individually, things like amoebas and algae and really, really cool stuff. But although they're small, these things are so important to the, you know, the world that we live in. And we've got a whole chapter on plants, another chapter on animals, and then finally we've got some rocks, gems, and minerals as well. So all in all, it's an extraordinary variety of things in the book.
And I can't help but feel that some of the things you're talking about here must have been quite hard to research. Look, I flipped open the page of the book, and it's landed on the page telling me about the corundum, which is a hard stone. There's only one other mineral that's harder out in the world, that's diamond. How did you research that?
So I'm really keen on not just using the internet, because the internet is a great resource, but it's actually quite unreliable at times. So at home, I have a forest of books. And my partner, my wife, is really keen that it's one in, one out. So every time I get a new book, another book's got to go. Unfortunately, we've got no more room in our house. But I just love books, other people's books. And writing this, I learned. So here's an example. There are beaches that are bright pink. So if you go to Bermuda, which is on the other side of the Atlantic, on the American side, there are beaches that are bright pink. And that's caused by the skeletons of millions and millions of tiny creatures. and they've got like these chalk-like skeletons. And you know, when you look at, you look online, you can find this quite easily. I'd never heard of this before. The little creatures, they're called star sand or forams, is their scientific name. And the book's full of little nuggets of information like that, because, you know, my two girls, they say, Dad, we don't want any boring facts, no daddy facts. So I'm always trying to find, you know, the sorts of things that are going to stick in your mind.
And there are some amazing things that you've included that perhaps might be a bit unusual that you have, really, when you speak of wonders of nature. There are some things, like we just heard, the second hardest mineral ever, but I'm looking at a page dedicated to the fig tree here, Ben.
Yeah.
Why is the fig made it in there?
So that's interesting, because quite a few of us have probably had figs, or we've seen them in a supermarket. And yet, you know, as a tree, that's a tree that has been cultivated for, you know, for thousands of years. And it's what I didn't realize until I was researching this, is its roots go deeper than any other tree. I think there was a mine somewhere where, you know, they're literally hundreds of meters below ground, and they found the roots of this tree. But what's really interesting is the way that fig trees have got this incredibly complicated relationship with these tiny, tiny fig wasps. And the tree can't survive without the fig wasp can't survive without the tree. And it's just this amazingly complicated relationship. I only had about 100 words to explain it. So in the book, it's just a brief description.
Now, Ben, let me take you back in time.
Yeah.
470 million years.
Right. You're going to probably... Go on, then.
We're not seeing any. There are no dinosaurs around. There are no mammals. There are no insects. What would we see all about, though, Ben?
So, although there were no animals, there were plants, but really, really basic plants. And one type of plant in particular, they're called liverworts. And they look a bit like floppy pieces of lettuce. Okay, so they don't really look like plants. You know, they don't have roots, they don't have stems, they don't have veins, they don't have flowers. They're really, really simple plants. But if you actually go into your garden or a park, or maybe you look at a flower pot in a garden centre, you can find these things, you know, the right end of your noses. And it's a really, really good example that you don't have to go to exotic places to find wonders of nature. In your own garden or your garden centre or down in your park, you can find these liverworts that have been on Earth longer than the dinosaurs, longer than any animals. And that is that's a living link to the past.
I'll take you now deep down into the ocean to one of the most basic forms of life I'd imagine that we have. Let me just take you through. I've flipped open the book again, and it's landed on the page of the Radiolarian. And there's a sentence that you've written here that really does stand out to me, Ben. It says, to eat the Radiolarian, they poke bits of their blobby body out of their holes to grab passing prey. Now, this Radiolarian must be tiny. They've got spines all over them. They look like a minute conker. What type of food are they eating? What's their prey?
So basically, these are part of the... So these microscopic life forms are essentially eating other microscopic life forms. So each one eats something a little bit smaller than itself. So they're a predator. They're not like... they're not like sharks chasing things around the ocean. But, you know, as I said earlier, just because they're small, they're really, really important. And you refer to its conch-like, you know, skeleton of these creatures, the Radiolarians. They're actually made of glass. I mean, if you imagine having a skeleton made of glass, it's just so different to the animals that we're familiar with. In fact, I think the microlife, they're some of the most amazing things in the book, actually.
Now, there are 100 epic things from nature in this book.
Yeah.
What's number 101? What didn't quite make the cut?
That's a good question. Do you know what, actually? I really wanted to put human beings in. And I had this idea that right at the end we should have humans, because the point I wanted to make is we are part of nature. You and me and everyone listening to this, we're all part of nature. We're part of the natural world. So I would have put us in, actually.
Now, you've not come empty-handed to this chat.
No,
you've got a bit of a science quiz for me.
It is. Are you ready? I'm not trying to trick you up. I've got they're fun questions, hopefully.
No, I'm more than ready. And you know, I'm a radio presenter. So I've not come empty-handed either. I've got some sound effects.
All right. Okay. Are you ready for the first question?
Go for it, Ben.
All right. So it's about pet cats. What can a pet cat do that a big cat like a jaguar can't?
Well, I know the big cats are pretty good at climbing. Things like cheetahs often just hang around on branches all day being quite lazy. Oh, can they purr? Can big cats not purr? Is it something simple like that?
No, that's absolutely right, yeah. So,
is that right?
It is right, yeah.
There you go. Sorry, go ahead.
That good sound. Yeah, so you can't, essentially if you cat, you can't roar and purr. So big cats can roar, and then all the other cats, which pet cats are on, they can purr. And in fact, jaguars and leopards, they also make a sound that, it sounds a bit like sawing wood, actually.
Now, very quickly, why can big cats roar, but they can't purr? Is that simply because they're much bigger, so their voice box is more developed?
It's to do with the structure of their throat. The structure of the throat is different. We could get really complicated really quickly, but
Well, let's move on to question two.
Okay, so snails move around on a muscular foot, right? So we all know that. But how much of its energy does a snail put into making its slime? So is it all of its energy, half of its energy, a third or a quarter?
Now, I spoke on the show recently about slugs and slug slime, the secret of it, the benefits of it. It's all a question about how much is stayed in and the difference between the slug and the snail slime, which there's a lot of S's. I reckon it can't be all of it. I'm going to go a quarter.
A quarter. It's actually a third.
Oh.
A third. So you're pretty close.
Pretty close. I think it must be one of these things that just happens. I mean, what benefit does a snail's slime have for a snail?
Well, there's multiple reasons. One, obviously, it helps lubricate so that the snail can slide around, but it also stops it drying out. Snails and slugs, they hate drying out. In fact, in our country, in winter, snails sort of, they retract into their shells and then they sort of seal up the hole, the entrance to their shell. So because, you know, in winter, they just dry out. They don't like the cold.
I'm half and half. I got one right, one wrong. Question three, please, Ben.
Question three. Okay. So what natural plant-like ingredient from the sea is found in toothpaste, shampoo, and puddings like ice cream?
Algae?
Yeah, that's right, actually. Yeah, I mean, seaweed is a type of algae.
Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that. Talk to us more. Why is that in so much that we use? Why is it necessary that it's in toothpaste?
So seaweed, like, for example, kelp, which is a type of seaweed that is a monster seaweed, actually. It grows as tall as trees, obviously, on the seabed. Seaweed is the source of this ingredient called agar that goes into the things I just described, toothpaste, shampoo, and ice cream. And, you can actually make ice cream at home without putting this extract in, but I think it just keeps them in, it helps improve the quality of those things. And so I like the fact that there's a seaweed in some, you know, you could be having some ice cream and you wouldn't realise it had got, you know, some seaweed in it. I think that's
it's almost the slime, isn't it? Right, I'm two for one, Ben. Hit me up with the fourth question.
Okay, so this is a little bit different. So the wombat, now that is an Australian mammal. It's marsupial like kangaroos, so it has its babies living in a pouch. So the wombat has a super smelly claim to fame. So what is so special about the wombat's poo?
Now, a wombat's poo is cube shaped, so it can't roll down hills, so they can mark their territory.
Absolutely right.
Yes, that's what it's one of my favourite animal facts. What more can you tell us about a wombat?
They are absolutely brilliant, aren't they? In fact, they're the only animals that make cube shaped poo, like little bricks. Well, because this animal spends all its time digging. If you've got you've got a pouch on the front with a baby in it, like we're familiar with koalas and kangaroos. If you're digging a lot and you've got this pouch in front, then your baby's going to get a face full of soil every time you dig a hole. Mm. So the wombat has got a backward-facing pouch. So the baby faces backwards so it doesn't get soil full of, you know, earth.
Yeah, when you see bits of, when you hear about pieces of science and evolution that's led to that, it's just mind-blowing, isn't it? Right, I'm doing well. I'm on three for one, so let's hit me up with the fifth question,
Ben. One more, question five. Okay, so a fairy ring is like a circle of toadstools. growing on a lawn or in a wood. How did that come about? Why have you got a circle of toads called fairy rings?
Now, this is, I mean, you've saved the toughest till last. I'm just, why would toadstools grow in a circle?
It is amazing. They are a perfect circle often.
No, I'm going to have to concede, actually. I'm gonna lose this question. What is it, Ben?
So what happens is that the fungus that we see, the toadstool, that is just like the fruiting part. But actually, most of the fungus is hidden. It's underground. And the soil is full of the threads. But it's like the roots of each fungus. They're called hyphae, and they're tiny threads that spread far and wide underground. That is the real business part of the fungus doing all the work. And when these hyphae from some fungi spread outwards evenly, all at the same rate, in certain situations, you get a perfect ring. And the same ring of fungi will appear year after year. You can actually see it leaves like a green mark. You can see like a green circle left in the grass. And of course, in the past, people didn't really understand about hyphae. So they came up with all these crazy theories about what they were, you know, that fairies used to gather there and dance around, you know, at certain times of year and all that sort of thing. So people used to be very superstitious about fairy rings.
When really it's just all going around under the soil, only we can't see. That's amazing. Mm. Lovely. Well, I got that wrong, so I'm going to have to give myself a customary boo. Sorry about that. Anyway, your book, though, it gets a big fat cheer from us here at the Fun Kids Science Weekly. It's called The Wonders of Nature, and it really is an absolute treat. It's such a visual spectacle, and you learn loads about some amazing bits of nature that you wouldn't really know.
I've just realised we didn't talk about my daughter's favourite facts in the book.
Oh, right.
They're going to listen to this podcast, and I'll be disappointed if I don't mention it.
Oh, right, OK. Well, go for it, Ben. I can't let anyone down.
So one of the creatures in the book is the lobster. We've got this little spiny lobster. And while I was writing it, I discovered that male lobsters don't use their claws to fight. They actually squirt wee in each other's faces.
Why?
Absolutely true. Well, I guess it's much better getting squirts with wee than having a, you know, ripping each other with pincers. So I guess it's, you know, it's a way of fighting each other without causing any damage. But do you know what? I think I'll leave that to lobsters.
Yeah, and let's not get any ideas from that. I don't think. Amazing. Yeah, the book is The Wonders of Nature. Ben Hoare, thank you so much for telling us all about it.
Pleasure. Thanks, Dan.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, and it's one that I can't believe we've not talked about before. It's one of the most mean and deadly creatures that there is around the world. And thankfully, it's been pushed my way by Toby, who suggested it over on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for this, Toby. He wants to know loads more about the second largest venomous snake in the world. It's the black mamba. They're a long, aggressive reptile. They're actually brown in colour, but they get their name from the black insides of their mouth. It's often the last thing that animals see right when they open it up before they're about to clamp down. You find them across savannas and around the rocky hills in Africa. The longest, they reach 14 feet long. Normally, they're quite shy, which is strange. If they're confronted, they'll try to slither away. But when they're absolutely cornered, they get angry. They raise their heads, they hiss, and then they strike repeatedly. Clamping down, biting. They inject huge amounts of toxic venom with each strike. Now, there is an anti-venom. The problem is, normally, it's not easily accessible around the places that the black mamba usually strikes. And if, after 20 minutes, you've not found it, things don't look that good for you. Now, the worst part about the black mamba is that it can move at speeds of up to 13 miles an hour, which is extraordinarily fast. And for that reason, for its speed and for its potency, it's considered one of the most deadly animals in the world. So we hear loads from scientists at the moment how we're in a climate crisis. Different weather patterns are happening all over the world. It's hot, it's cold, it's rainy, it's baking, boiling in some places too. Let's find out more about that now, and more about the climate with Marina Ventura.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Now, we all like talking about the weather. In fact, people in Britain are well known for it.
The weather's quite good. It's quite hot and it's quite sunny.
Windy and very cold.
A bit rainy.
Freezing.
About a bit sunny.
Very windy. All of the leaves are falling off the trees.
Talking about the weather is one of the ways we start conversations, especially with people we don't know. One of the reasons for this is because it's something we have in common with everyone around us. If it's a rainy day and I get soaked in a downpour, you might have got wet too. And if it's freezing cold, then you're probably feeling it as well. And weather is a topic that everyone has an opinion about. Maybe it's chillier than it was yesterday. Perhaps you didn't expect to need a coat because you thought it was going to be a bit warmer. Not knowing quite what to expect means it's often surprising. That's why people like to read, listen to, or watch weather forecasts every day to help make sure they've got the right clothes on.
And with rain heading down south, tomorrow is set to be wet, so don't forget your umbrella.
After all, no one likes getting soaked. But weather's quite a strange thing. Even if it's cold and wet on one day, the next day can be very different. And not everyone gets the same weather, even when they're in the same country.
Schools in the north of England will be shut today due to heavy snow. But in the Midlands, there's no snow, so schools are open as usual. Sorry, kids.
So as you can see, weather is constantly changing, which is probably why it's so interesting. As we've seen, weather forecasts help us to know what to expect, but even without them, we have a feeling about what the weather should be like at different times of the year. We expect it to be cold in winter and warmer in summer. Have you ever wondered why this is? Let's find out. Let's ask MapApp. He's great at explaining things.
It's all to do with climate. There's a saying, weather is what you get and climate is what you expect. And that's a great way to remember the difference. Weather describes what the conditions are like at a particular time and place, whilst climate is what the weather is generally like at that time of year. Here in the UK, winters are generally mild and summers, well, they don't get too hot. We have what's called a temperate climate.
So how do they figure out what the climate is?
Scientists constantly take measurements of the weather, things like temperature and rainfall, and they do this over many years. This gives them a lot of information and helps them to see patterns. These patterns help describe the climate.
Most people will never have seen those measurements, but we still know that our winters are usually cold. How come?
During everyone's lifetimes, people learn about the patterns in weather. And as you've described, because weather is a popular topic of conversation, these ideas have always been shared. What is interesting is that just like the weather, those patterns that make up our climate can gradually change too. And because scientists keep track of weather measurements from the past, they can spot these slow changes.
Fascinating, Mappy. Next time, we'll explore how climates differ in different parts of the world. See you then.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
Right, let's have a look at all the science that's in your news. Researchers have discovered a nearly complete 3.8 million year old skull of an early ape-like human ancestor. It was found in Ethiopia, and it challenges ideas of how we first evolved. Scientists now think that this species, Australopithecus anamensis, was the ancestor of a later, more advanced ape species, and it shows that the line of human evolution isn't clean and smooth. It's a bit higgledy-piggledy. It goes all over the place. Also, the teenage activist Greta Thunberg, she's arrived in New York after a 15-day, 3,000-mile voyage across the Atlantic. She sailed there from Plymouth in the UK on a zero emissions yacht to minimise her carbon footprint, and then she'll participate in UN climate summits in New York City and Chile as well. And finally, the American rocket company SpaceX, it conducted a successful flight of its Starhopper testbed. The vehicle, it was lifted 150 metres into the air, moved sideways, wiggled around a bit, and then gently floated back down to the ground. It's an effort to make a new engine that burns liquid methane, and it's hoped to travel to Mars one day. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. We've got loads more of the science series that you've heard today. Marina Ventura, Sydney McSprocket, and there's tons more for you to catch up on. Over on our free Fun Kids app, it's on Apple Podcasts as well. All the podcast places, Google, Spotify, things like that. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, by the way, and you want me to answer one of your science questions, just head over to the review page. Find us on there. There's a little comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question. I'll see it, and I might say hello in the next few weeks. Also, you can get us on the free Fun Kids app. Fun Kids are a children's radio station from the UK. You can listen all over the country on that app. We're on the DAB digital radio as well. And you can always find us at funkidslive.com.